If you love the Mixing Music Podcast but want deeper, ad-free, technical episodes, we've got you covered. Our Patreon gives you access to over 250 exclusive episodes and new content every single week, all focused on mixing, mastering, and engineering at a high level. For just $4 a month, you get practical tips and techniques that will instantly improve your sound. Join now at MixingMusicPodcast.com/exclusive. Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host DK, and with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Luscious Lips Lou. Okay, that was gross.
I did not.
I should. That was gross. I regret
it. Did I make you blush?
Okay. And then we have a very, very special guest. First time on the show. We have all the way from Asheville, North Carolina, Eric Serafin, a.k.a. Mixer Man. Welcome to the show, Mixer Man.
Yay. Yeah.
All right.
Real briefly, before we get started into this episode, I just want to, you know, create some credibility. If y'all have heard me talk about how I'm reading this book right now called Zen and the Art of Mixing, Eric wrote this book, Mixer Man wrote this book damn near 10, 15 years ago and has gone through a couple revisions already. I love this book. There are all sorts of books about audio engineering that I've read for college or just offhand. This is one of my favorites. And I'm not like glazing you. I'm being authentic. I love, it's like the perfect combination of practical, but like ambiguous and open-ended enough to be applicable for, you know, the Hollywood record maker and the North Dakota home studio owner. Like it's encompassing for anyone that's pursuing a career, which again is the entire basis of the podcast. Is like helping people understand what to expect, not just for the sake of the art, but for the sake of the career. The good news is, and the reason why we have Mixer Man here on the show, why we have Eric here on the show, is because he came out with a brand new book. This thing is a behemoth of all sorts of information. Mixer Man's Ultimate Guide to Producing Records, Music, and Songs. There it is, if you're watching on video. The Antidote to Misinformation. Everything you need to know about producing, recording, mixing, and mastering music at home or in the studio.
It's a big book.
Big book.
A chunky looking one.
600 pages. Now,
there's already a couple music industry books out there, like Everything You Need to Know About the Music Industry, which has like 20,000 versions, revisions that has been already out. There's like Ari's about like marketing and like promoting the artist. And that's fun and like that's good. And those are like reference guides that I think even engineers should read. But the cool thing about this book, Mixer Man's Ultimate Guide to Producing Records, Music, and Songs, is that I think it is specific to listeners of this podcast, specific to producers and engineers. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about labels and how they screw you over if you don't have this specific clause in there. It's more than that. And it's very practical. And I want to talk to Eric about this. Do you want to say anything more specific about the book or like how you came up with this? Why you felt the need to make a new book, especially today's time?
Yeah. So first, I appreciate the fact that you like the Zen and the Art of Mixing. That's my best-selling book by far. I sell a lot of copies of that book, still do. And I'm hoping to make the new book just as big a seller. I spent a lot of time online. I made my bones as Mixer Man. The whole Mixer Man thing came from being online as an anonymous donor of my knowledge and information earlier in my career. And so I still spent a lot of time reading groups, reading what people say or asking. And, you know, it just seemed to me that there aren't like dedicated producers anymore. Not like it used to be. It used to be there were people that were producers. Now everybody's got to be a producer. Nobody's hiring a producer. They're either an engineer who's operating as a producer and mastering and mixing and doing everything, or they're an artist or a songwriter, and they got to learn how to record, and they got to learn how to get the best out of themselves. And so the premise of the book was, okay, well, everybody's a producer, but that means you got to learn the engineering, you got to learn the arranging, the songwriting, and the mastering, the mixing. And, you know, that took me 40 years to learn all of that stuff. So how are you going to learn all of that stuff and condense it down so that you can, you know, not only make great songs, but make great productions too, that set the song off and do what you need them to do? Because you don't really have 40 years to do it. You're going to be old. So you got to do it fast. And so I set out to write a book that would explain everything, first of all, about what a producer does traditionally and how a producer operates. And I talk about the different kinds of producers, and there's a lot of them. And then I talk about the songwriting and the arranging, because that's actually the most important part of getting what you need out of a great record. Because you get that right, the sound comes along with it. And a lot of people think about sound as the most important thing. And it's actually, it's the most important in that it's a means to the end, because we're dealing with sound. But focusing on sound is actually the worst place to put your focus, because if you focus on the arrangement, you are focusing on sound. But if you focus on sound, you're not focusing on the right thing, and your results will not necessarily be as great as you hoped. So, and then of course I go into a little bit of the business stuff so that you can understand, you know, the basic contracts and the clauses that go into that and all that. And I go through all the plugins for the home producer and everything, and how you operate as a home producer and producing yourself, and which is much more difficult than operating as a dedicated producer, because no one's there to talk you down off a cliff, and you know you don't have anybody there to help you deal with your doubts or to listen and to be a sounding board for you. So that's the basic premise of the book. I wrote it so that it would help everybody that I could, with everything that goes into producing records, music, and songs.
Nice.
You know, that's actually really cool, because there are a lot of artists that I talk to where you're right. We kind of are in a time where everybody is kind of everything, and they at some point kind of need to be at the start of their career, because a lot of people don't want to get involved right away and hop on helping every single artist they meet, unless they see like, oh, you're actually taking this serious. Oh, you actually are putting out a product. But you know, it's really hard finding people at first. So they are trying to learn as much as they can, but they don't know where to start. So this actually sounds like a really cool book to actually get them started. You know, there's a lot of like, I'm sure you've met like producer dads, producer moms, and things of that nature, where their kid wants to be an artist, but they want to be able to help them out somehow.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, that's kind of like the thought I'm having, because I know a lot of artists were like momagers, dadagers, and stuff like that were involved early on, but now that they have something going on, you know, they've got an actual producer, manager in the industry. So like this book could actually simplify a lot of things for a lot of people.
It'll also help someone who's like, you know, an artist eventually is going to want a producer. I mean, the goal is to get to the point where you're going to hire a producer, right? So the more you learn and the more you understand how to do these processes and what a producer does, the easier it is to find the right producer for you.
Yeah.
So let's go into, so what I want to do for this episode is that you have seven sections of the book. And I want to go through kind of each of the sections, what that section's a little bit about. And the first section is a question that I get all the time. First section is called The Producer. And basically, when people ask me, like, especially those friends that are not in the industry, what is a music producer? I'm like, buckle up, sit down, because no one has a clue. No one has a clue. What does that mean? So this first section is all about what producers are. You have chapters on the songwriter producer, the musician producer, the engineer producer, the music fan producer. What is your, let's just start off with, what is your definition of a producer right now?
Well, I mean, from the traditional sense, a producer really is just a liaison between the artist and the label, and is there to, meet the requirements for each of those kind of somewhat opposing sides, right? But really, you know, the producer is there to make it happen. Like, a label hires me as a producer because they want to make sure that they have someone in the room that's going to deliver them a product. They don't want to give all this money and then say, we can't finish it. So someone who has a track record of finishing records and can do it. Now, how the producer operates to accomplish that depends completely on the person and how they run things. I mean, you know, Rick Rubin does not produce the same way as someone who can I say?
Kanye.
Kanye. I don't know how Kanye produces.
Is the musical genius, according to his own words, and Rick Rubin is musically illiterate in his own words.
Any option, and we just go with
Kanye. Rick is an overseer. So he's much more of an, you have overseers who just, you know, bring me the dailies and I'll tell you whether it's good or what I want you to change. And he's kind of comes from the music fan producer side of things, but he's also in the business. And then you have people that are much more hands-on. Like for me, if I'm producing, everything goes through me. I'm there from moment one to the end. I touch everything. I'm a part of the whole process. And even if I'm in the back of the room sleeping on the couch, I got one ear open and I know what's going on. And the moment anything isn't working right, I'm going to pop up and we're going to be fixing it. So, you know, I went through the different kinds of producers, the music fan producer, which sounds ridiculous, but I've worked with several of them. J.P. Plunier, who produced the three Ben Harper records that I mixed. He comes from a music fan place. He knew nothing about making music. He only knew, like, he just had this, he had a club in France. He had this massive understanding of different kinds of songs and he brought that into the session. And then he would hire someone like me or other engineers and, they could help him through the other things. So, you know, as a producer, you could hire people to fill in where you're deficient. Like Rick Rubin could never record an album, so he hires engineers. He doesn't want to run it, so he hires engineers that can run a session and that can run a session like a producer so that he doesn't have to be there all the time. And if you don't know how to arrange, you can hire an arranger. You know what I'm saying? So the producer just needs to make it happen. How they make it happen is really up to them, and there's no right or wrong. There is only what's right for you as an artist, or what's right for the artist as the producer. And, you know, I'm not the right producer for all artists. Nobody is. And so there has to be, and, you know, I actually go through this in the book. I go through an extensive interview process just to determine whether this is an act that I can produce. And they have to know that I'm a producer that can produce them. And once we know that, then we can really talk about, you know, making that happen.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a very important to actually, because yesterday at an event, I was talking about this with a manager, things that he looks for in artists, things of that nature. One of them was trust in the roles. You know, you trust me to actually manage your career and to help you build from where you're at. So like you mentioned right now, it's like, hey, you know, do you believe I can produce you and therefore we can actually build something together? If not, this is probably just folly, and recognizing that early on is actually really key.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, they just want the gig. And so they're like, oh, I'll produce you. And they don't really consider all the headaches that come along with that if you don't really vet who you're dealing with. And, you know, I mean, for me, I'll even, as a tactic, on the first rehearsal, when we're just getting to know each other, I'll just do my most radical idea right up front, because that tells me right away whether they're going to be able to handle, you know, what I'm going to throw at them. And if they can handle that, if they revolt and they go, this is my record, man, then it's like, okay, Well, have fun making your record then. I'm not the right guy for you. You know? Yeah. So that's a protection.
I'm the way that I'm thinking about this and in taking this too is in like a hopeful, empowering way in the marketplace here is that like every artist that needs help finishing a record has to find a producer that aligns with them creatively, but as well as process too. Like some artists write their songs completely, have chords, already have a sense of prosody, right? Already have a sense of like the direction that they want to go on, and they just need to fill it out, arrangement. Some artists have no musical sense whatsoever, and they're more poets, and they need melodies fed to them. And then whatever it is. So there's this, if you want to be an engineer producer, right? There, the cool thing is that there's always going to be new artists, people that are in search for your style specifically. And I think that's like really cool because like you can be competing with a bunch of people on the street, and the way that you produce, the way that you process your systems, the way that you creatively work together, these are all unique to you and can help you stand out with different clients as well. So like I just like based on the needs of the artist, the needs of the client, as well as like, you know, what you can give to the industry. So I'm thinking about like, if there's like a producer in Iowa that is able to do everything, there might be another one down the street that's like, okay, I'm just a hip hop producer. I'm trying to look at the music fan producer. There's probably not a lot of music fan producers in Iowa, but like the musician producer, right? And so like
musicians go to producing, yeah.
Yeah. So that's just something that I'm thinking about. It's like how big the marketplace can actually be for this sort of stuff.
But here's the thing. Like you say you gotta attract people that match your style, whatever. But as a producer, it doesn't really matter. Like there's genres that I can't stand, but I've made records in those genres because it was a record that like I felt stood out, that I could relate to, that I really loved. And and I've made records in a way that's outside of how I would normally produce too, because I can adjust to that. It's not that I have to be hands-on. It's just that I kind of gravitate towards bands and artists that need that. But if an act comes along that's looking for a producer and I can see that they really need me to be more hands off, or they're like this kind of person that's kind of this multi-instrumentalist genius, it's better for me to kind of just harness their genius than it is to try and direct them and to try and keep them on focus and keep them on path. That I will work in that manner. So as a producer, you kind of got to find the thing that you love first and foremost. You find the thing that you love, then you got to figure out what is the best way for me to produce this, rather than to say, well, I'm going to produce this the same way that I produce all my records, because that's where I get my success from. And if you start with things that you love and you figure out the best way to make the record, then you're being creative and you're looking for the possibilities of making the best record possible.
Yeah. Especially like if you're in endeavoring to be a professional, a burgeoning professional. I'm curious, like, if you are someone that is looking to make a career out of this, where do you think that line between service-oriented, I'll do whatever you want, and like being flexible is with knowing your limits?
Well,
do you think that changes over time?
It could change over time. I mean, personally, I was never service oriented. I was never like this kind of guy that said, oh, I'll do whatever you want, because I felt there was very little value in that. So, you know, if you just want to get paid by the hour and you don't care, and it's like you just want people to give people what they want and make them happy and send them on their way, then that's perfectly legitimate. But for me, I wanted to make amazing records with amazing artists. And so if I'm not there to really get it to that place, then why am I there? So like even as a mixer, because I mixed for many years exclusively, just mixed every day for probably well over a decade in the 90s. And I was not there to go and have you tell me to add top end to this and add this. No. That was not what we did. I was there to deliver the mix, and then we would talk about what things you want to make the change of it. If I completely missed the boat, okay, go. We'll talk about what the concept is, and I'll go with that concept. Or I'm going to say, no, I think this is the best mix you're going to get. This is it. You know, but I wasn't there to service their needs like, oh, this is, you're the client, you get what you want. No, you're hiring me because I'm an expert at this. And if at the end you decide that you don't like what I've delivered, then you're going to hire somebody else. But that doesn't happen often, but that's the reality of how I operate. And that makes me more valuable because now I'm being hired for my consultation rather than for my ability to operate equipment and to do certain things, right?
Yeah. That attitude kind of came across in Zen and the Art of Mixing, which I actually kind of liked. Like that, like, hey, I'm the professional you hired, and exactly. I'm here to be that professional. I think that's a pretty solid attitude.
And to be honest, a lot of people are looking for that because one of the relationships I have with one of my clients is very much, if I ever try to explain the solution or something to it, his response is always, listen, man, that sounds like gibberish to me. As long as you got it, I'm okay.
Yeah.
Like some clients do not care. They just trust you just entirely. And as long as it's good, it's good.
Yeah. I don't even consider you a mixer. I wouldn't call anybody who is going to do whatever the client wants a mixer. That's not what a mixer is. That's a mixing engineer. You're being hired to do what they want. You're being paid hourly. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with it, but you're not a mixer. If you're a mixer, then you're an expert and they're hiring you for your expertise and they're hiring you because you're going to bring up the track and you're going to listen to it and you're going to go, oh, I know what this needs, and it may be just perfectly straight ahead where what they expected, and it may be completely off the wall, something that they never even expected. But you're bringing in your artistic and your creative sensibilities to the process to make it better.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's get into the next section here, section two, which is called songwriting and arranging. Before we get into this, you said something at the beginning that I've said many times before, and I remember one time, I forgot who I said it to, what the situation was, but I mentioned to another engineer that I think arranging is significantly more important than the mix. If you can't get the arrangement right, then it's really going to be working against the mix. And for some reason, I just remember this other, I think it was a mixer too. It just like triggered him and like hurt his pride in a way that made him really defensive. I was like, how can you argue about this? Like, what are you talking about? Like, if you have the producer that had like a smaller, less subby bass in the verse and like an expanded low end in the chorus, like that's naturally going to bring in energy before I do anything. Yep. Like, or like better use of top end from verse to chorus or into each section. Like, what are you talking about? Like, I have to do less work if it's really well arranged.
Absolutely.
This
arranging. Next section. I mean, really.
Oh my goodness.
Because I don't keep everything everybody gives me. Like if they give me like 100 tracks, we're going to be getting rid of some tracks. Like, you know, I don't want the mix small. So sometimes people just put too much shit in, you know, but mixing is arranging. That's what it is.
Yes. Yeah, so in this section, you talk about forward motion. You talk about bass. You talk about drops. You talk about phrasing. You talk about what arranging is. You talk about counter melodies, responses, rhythms, masking, harmonic series, low end. Like this section is very filled with everything about arranging and songwriting. What are some of the important parts that you want to talk about?
I mean, it's all important, you know.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Like, as you know, a lot of it, I do touch on a lot of the things. I think the most important principle is the forward motion aspect of everything, because a lot of people don't understand that, you know, we're dealing with time here. We're dealing with sound over time. And the way to manipulate the listener is to manipulate how they react over that time. And so, you know, everything's relative. If you have a verse that's sparse and then and mellow, and then the chorus comes in and it's big and it's got gritty guitars and it's bright, then that's a dynamic. That's contrast. And, mm-hmm. you know, we make our records very loud now, so there's not a lot of difference in volume, in level, between the verse and the chorus. So we have to use other ways to create the illusion of a dynamic, and contrast is how we do it. And the forward motion aspect of that is we need to push the listener forward through the song. This is true of all creative endeavors, whether you're writing books, whether you're making movies, long form series, whatever, anything that has someone viewing or listening, you have to push them through. Otherwise, they're going to hit skip. They're going to move on to something else. And so we have concrete ways as songwriters to push the listener forward. And a great song will do that naturally. So what we want to do is we want to do things in the recording and the production and the arrangement that mirror that, and where there is a lack of forward motion from the song that generate it for us. And so the more forward motion we can generate, the more payoff you get. And the more payoff you get, the more people will react to the song. And that is probably the most important concept of songwriting and arrangement in general.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I have two things to say real quick. This is one of those things where this is one of those sections where I am not necessarily promoting going to school for music. I'm very neutral about that. That is a personal decision that you make. But I am saying that having like been to a proper music school where I had to take theory and oral skills and learn these terms and applications and scenarios where these different terms and ideas are used, gives me a better sense of how to articulate the things that I'm feeling, or like what contrast really means. The second thing that I want to talk about is, I'm just realizing this right now, in a previous episode, it's got damn near 2 years ago, was, Lou, you may remember this, I had a list of 5 ways to create depth in a mix. And I had a list mm-hmm. of 5 things that you should focus on mm-hmm. to create like left and right, forward, back, up and down. Yeah. I did not read your 5 planes of space. I swear on my life that I did not read it. This is an isolated, but I have the same exact, like you use different words. I have almost the same exact list. This is really good. You're just affirming what I, I'm not
because
crazy.
Because they exist, dude. I didn't make them up. I didn't make the shit up. I'm just defining it. And so you defined it in a different way than I did. But the thing, all of that shit exists, you know? This is fact.
Yeah. It is objective truth.
It is objective truth. Yeah. And so you figured it out the same way that I figured it out, and you expressed it in the way that you expressed it. But, you know, some people don't figure it out as fast as others. And so I lay it out there because it really helps with how you conceptualize space, which is very important in mixing.
So I'm going to briefly read it for the audience here. First is panning, which is left to right space. Frequency, which is up and down space. Contrast, which is perceived dynamics. I personally call this like density.
It's reflectivity. Part of density.
Yeah, yeah.
Density's part of it, yeah.
Reflectivity, sorry. Which is far to near, and balance, front to back, large to small. I just find it super fascinating that it's like, that's damn near almost exactly. All right. There is some objective truth to all of this. We're not just crazy trying to grasp in a void, trying to figure out a truth that doesn't exist. All right. That was nice. Section number 3. Let's get into this. This section's called The Home Producer. And I know for a fact that most of the audience here, especially because most people are not in major music cities, you know, and there's a lot of, there is money to be made, careers to be, relatively stable careers to be had in non-music cities. I started my career in Utah. There were, in my single city or maybe two cities surrounding me, there were like a solid three or four, like, dads with families running studios, some of them out of their home, some of them in a commercial space. Like, there are markets for this. So let's talk about the home producer, what that means for you, and kind of this section.
Well, I'm a home producer. You know, this, I'm in a room in my home right now. So, like, in fact, that's the reason that I could move to Asheville, was because of the changes in technology. I didn't need to be in LA anymore. I could get work from all over the world. We can thank the internet for that. So I'm like, well, I like LA. I like the weather, but I don't like the expense. So moved to Asheville. And so, you know, if I need to go to the studio, because if I want to cut drums, I will not cut drums at my house. I want to be in a proper studio with proper microphones and equipment and lots of compressors and the space that's necessary to capture the drums exactly as I want them. But the rest of the record I can do completely from this room, because I'm almost never using more than one or two mics. And if I am, then once again, I rent out a room. So, because, you know, it doesn't appreciably raise the budget to do that. But home producer is anybody who produces out of their home. And there's not, you know, I think the biggest limitation is drums. If you wanted to do an actual string ensemble, of course, you need a studio for that. There are certain things that a studio is beneficial for. But 99% of stuff can be done out of the studio, out of your home. Just like, you know, we have music libraries, sample libraries. Like, the stuff that you can do with sample libraries is incredible. It's tedious as fuck, but, you know, to get all the articulations right and to get the different sample things together, you, like, got to construct thing. And of course, you know, generative AI is going to change all of that. We won't need any of that soon, because you're going to have a generative audio workstation, and you're going to, well, if you need a horn section, you're going to prompt for your horn section. And, you know, people get all bent out of shape about that. Well, that's not creative. Well, you can write the horn parts too, and it can just play them if you want, which will save you a lot of money. But, and it'll save you a lot of time too. Anyway, so basically anybody who works from home is a home producer. And that includes if you're songwriting and you're an artist or whatever. If you're doing it at home, you're a home producer, and you have, there's a certain process that goes into it, which is building a track from top to bottom. You're not recording a band all at once. You're building, you're doing, using the overdub method to build your track.
Yeah. So in this section, there are subsections about, like, everything about microphones, the gear, different types of microphones, art and technicalities, which is about, like, things like polarity, mono, stereo, source, acoustics, what the heck diffusers are. You have an entire section on just all the different types of plugins here. This is quite a substantial section that, like, if you've ever had any questions about anything, I'm sure it's like, what the heck is a VCA compressor? You have a section for that. Mm-hmm. Aux sense, pre-fader, post-fader, BU meters, you know, gain staging. This is quite a comprehensive section here.
The only thing there is, you know, it doesn't tell you how to fall in love. And that's my only gripe.
Yeah, this is the technical section. Which, you know, I try to write the technical sections in a way that you do not need to be a technical person. I am not a technical person. You know, after 40 years of doing this, I'm way more technical than I used to be. In fact, in the early 90s, I wore it as a badge of honor. I don't know anything about the tech. All I know is music and how to get it to sound and cause people to react. But over the years, I've learned it, and I've learned how to use it, and I try to explain everything in a way that's accessible and, you know, doesn't get too deep into the weeds, but really maintains a practical kind of approach. And, you know, the acoustics, everything that I know about acoustics is learned by reading, by trial and error. Like, I am not, and I say it in there, I am not an acoustics expert. So everything that I'm going to give you here is just what I've learned from doing it myself and what I've learned from reading extensively. And, you know, it took me going from million-dollar mix rooms to my house was a very difficult transition. And, you know, I went through very painful periods of time where, like, I just felt like I couldn't do what I wanted to do because I just didn't have my room in a way that I could deliver. People don't understand, oh, if you're a talented mix engineer, you could be mixing any room. No, any room can make you ineffective as a mix engineer because you don't know what you're hearing anymore. So, and if you don't know what you're hearing, then none of your decisions make any sense. And then you take it to your car and it blows up the speakers in your car and you're like, what the hell is going on? Well, you can't hear 160 hertz. And you're like, well, no, when I play this song or this song or this reference song, it sounds fine. Yeah, because those songs can live without that 160 hertz, but you're still not hearing it. So when you're like doing your moves and your stuff, you're dealing with frequencies that you absolutely cannot hear. And you get it out of your room and you put it in your car, and now all of a sudden you can hear them, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the problem. And it's especially, this is why people are talk so much about getting the low end right. The top end, you know, if you've got enough absorptive material in your room, the top end's not the issue. It's almost always the low end that's the issue. And yeah. So, you know, I talk about all the things and I explain to people, you got to figure out a way to either make your room so that it has some accuracy, or you're going to have to get yourself some headphones that can offer you some accuracy. But if you think you're just going to reference your way out of a problematic room, that's just not going to happen. I mean, I would mix for, you know, a couple hours. I'd be rocking away. This is fucking great. It's great. I'd leave the room. I'd come back 10 minutes later and it'd be completely different. I'd be like, what the fuck is going on? Like, and so I'd like a job. Okay, the low end is just blowing everything. I'm going to adjust everything and make it. All right, this is great. Take a 10-minute break. I come back. Completely different. And I'm like, I don't understand what's going on. No matter what I do, I go back and forth like a seesaw on the low end to make it too much, too little, too much, too little. And I come back the next day. It never sounds the same. That is a function of a room that is not accurate. That's what happens.
The most relatable
story.
Lou, I'm sure you could talk on this, but there's been two moments from friends and friends on YouTube explaining things. You said that even with acoustics and of course with mixing, in your book, Zen and the Art of Mixing, one of my favorite quotes is you say, mixing is not something that can really be taught. It can only be learned, which is like an old Zen quote, right? And it's really good. I really like that concept because it's really experiential and you have to trial and error. Like you, every song is different. Every genre is different. Every style is different. Every room is different. Every mixer is different. Every whatever, right? One of the things that there's two experiences where it really humanized this experiential process for me. One of our good friends, I won't name him for the sake of, you know, saving face, just in case that he's not proud of this moment. One of our good friends, Lou, Grammy-winning mixer, went on YouTube, mixed an entire record. And then at the end of this two-hour live stream, he like references back to the mix he had done previous. And he's like, well, I don't like this new mix half as much as the old mix. And that's how it goes sometime. End stream. Like, that was just like, that's just how it ended. And then there's another even bigger, like an older, older, more recognized engineer was making a YouTube series about acoustics. And he's like going into the theory of it. I've locked down the hyper nerd. I'm not going to say his name, but again, you've probably, if you're really deeply into engineering, you've probably seen this video series. Hour long videos. There's about six of them. Okay. He's going on about the theory of membrane corner traps to get the low end. And then he's like, finally, 6 hour, like 1 hour each, 6 hours, six videos. At the very end of the final video, he like implements it, does the measurements, and Wizard's like, so that changed nothing.
Oh my God.
It was zero improvement. Yeah. And he's like, that sucks. And he just like, it posted. It was like, this is such a humanizing experience. Like, like that's how it really is sometimes.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Like we could talk theory all day long, but my goodness. My goodness.
Yeah, it's kind of funny cuz like recently like you know, I've been doing a lot of live stuff. I had left live for years. And then I would do it in the background for like one specific client, just like one day a week kind of thing. Never talked about it, never really posted much about it. Now I'm doing a lot more of it. And, you know, it's kind of like you were saying, you know, changing rooms when mixing, even for a studio environment, changes how you're going to listen to your speakers and this and that. And like understanding the fundamental, like, yeah, like learning the technical side, the type of plugins, what type of processors there are, what kind of approaches exist, the techniques behind it. Theory is great, but like when you're moving from one room to the next, you could have the same console, different console. You can have the same mics, same musicians, but the performance is very different. The approach to the surrounding noise, if you're in a studio doing like a live recording of a band in a tight live room or in a big open live room, doesn't really matter. You could have all the theory in the world, but once it comes time to implement it, it's really the decision making that makes the difference between each individual is what I've seen. You know, you can I'm forgetting his name, the mixing engineer for Iron Maiden, Ken Pooch, I think his name is, for concerts. You know, he puts a lot of content out lately, you know, that's kind of the thing we all do nowadays, right? Yeah. But one of the things he points out as a big part is, you know, I can give you my template, I can give you my console, all my hardware, the same band, you will still mix it very differently than me. And even then, every night I'm mixing it differently because we're in a different venue with different speakers, with different stage, different troubles to try to troubleshoot, even if everything else is identical.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is like, I don't see these so much, but in the early aughts, there were, once DAWs really started coming in, people would run these like mix competitions or, and so you'd and you'd listen to like 10 to 20 mixes of the same song. And it's like, and of course, there were some that stood out and there were some that were just like, okay, I don't even know what you're listening to. But, even within that high variance, like at some point you're like, did any of these really appreciably change how I felt about this track? And none of it mattered. And it's like, yeah, okay, the guy who made it too thin, I don't really want to listen to that. Understood. Mm-hmm. You know, someone would invariably really set the thing off pretty nice, but like it didn't change that much. Like it was shocking how even with that difference, there really wasn't that much difference between all these different mixes. And the mixes were different, but your reaction to the song was exactly the same. So it's just a bit overhyped, you know, just how important mixing is. And I say that as a mixer, and I view mixing important. But when you have a song that's got to be mixed pretty straight ahead and you're only going to have so many variations of it and there's nobody really coming in with something creative to like kind of save the whole thing, then they all pretty much sound the same.
There's the story of the new Wicked movie that came out earlier this year, And Greg Wells is in charge of mixing everything. And then I think the story goes is, and I might be butchering this, Ariana Grande, of course, wanted it mixed, her vocals mixed by her usual mixer, which is, who's the top guy? What's his name?
You're talking about
Serban. She wants it mixed by Serban. And like, obviously Greg is a great mixer. And at that point, that was the first time I realized like, oh, it's just like baseball mysticism. You know, it's just like, people being, a little superstitious.
Yeah.
And they feel like they need to spit on the mound in order to have a good pitch. Like there's not much difference in the role of a mixer sometimes. Anyway, that was a little unrelated, but
But that's true because there are plenty of people who, they like the way they work with somebody sometimes, and that's the difference between why they go with one mixer versus another. It's not necessarily the quality every time. Sometimes it's just the forms of communication that they have, the understanding between the terminologies. For instance, like I said earlier, like with one of my clients, if I mention EQ, it's already mumbo jumbo, like just out the gate with the word EQ, you know, even the abbreviation, whatever. But point is, like, she could have a great relationship with Serban that just, he knows what he likes typically. And if there's any changes needed, there's like maybe some level of simplicity behind it. Whereas maybe she has worked with Greg in the past. Maybe she hasn't. Maybe she's a little nervous about that. And it just makes her feel more at peace knowing that her team is involved, at least on certain factors.
Right. But it's all about her because, you know, the thing is that it's still Ariana. So, like, it's going to be great no matter what. Like, it's hard to fuck up greatness. And that's the thing. But for her, like, maybe she has very unusual particularities that she's already gone through with Serban that are very important to her for some reason. For us, we'll listen to it and go, damn, no matter what, right? And even even if we're, like, knowledgeable, we're not going to be like, oh, this reverb really sets her off much better than this reverb. It doesn't work like that. For her, like for us, we make a tiny change on our own mix. We're like, oh my God, that made the biggest fucking difference. Holy shit. That is the difference between this being shit and a fucking hit, right? But that's not true. We hear that. We feel that. But anybody else is like, did you do something? You know what I'm saying? And so like, and even as knowledgeable professionals, we'll be like, did you do something? Even if we kind of didn't notice it, like we'll probably notice something, but certainly more than the punter. But did it really change anything? No. But for her, if it gives her comfort, if it makes her feel better, okay, I'm Greg Wells. I'm like, all right, Serban, send me your fucking vocal and I'll put it in there. What does it matter? You just saved me time.
Yeah.
Right. Same thing with baseball. The same thing with baseball. It's like if there's someone in the dugout that's like, I have to do this ritual, this superstitious ritual. What manager would be like, no, that's dumb. Don't do that. You don't have like, no, you'd be like, whatever gets you in the right headspace, you do whatever it takes.
Do whatever you want.
Get in the right headspace. Right.
You know, and it's funny because we've talked about this before at the studio because DK and Ivy, we had in the mix studios for years. And something we enjoyed doing was like, I think it was every Monday or every Tuesday, we did kind of a meeting, just kind of get together with the team and everything. And also then dedicated like 30 minutes to an hour to some kind of lesson that we thought was practical and useful. And one of the ones that we talked about was what's a good mix? You know, what in our opinion is a good mix? And the thing I always come back to is the 128 kilobit MP3 version of the song Crawling in the Dark by Hoobastank. You know, got me crawling in the dark, looking for the answer. I remember listening to that. And as a kid, I was like, this song fucking rocks. Oh, that's so good. And then I bought the album and, you know, I'm a stupid kid. I don't know quality yet. You know, I didn't know I wanted to engineer yet. So I'm just, you know, fan. I'm just strictly a fan at this moment. Yeah. There's no technical thought. I bought the CD and now I'm listening to the full uncompressed audio file on, well, you know, we'll see what the technology was then versus now, but I'm sure it was the full uncompressed audio file because all of a sudden the kick drum hits harder. All of a sudden the snare is a lot more transient. All of a sudden the vocals don't sound like there's like this digital mush on them anymore. Yeah. The guitars actually sound like a wall of sound versus like this over squished kind of thing. And I remember listening to them like, well, this is different, but it's the same song, whatever. And, you know, still jamming out. It like, I think me and DK had described a quality mix as something that's not distracting before. That as a kid, it shines through so much more when we talk about like, what is a good mix? Cause you're right. The quality of the mixes in this scenario that you said, like, hey, 20 different mixers, one record, they may not have sounded that much different, but the perceived reaction to them could be that much different to, let's say, a fan. Cause a fan usually doesn't know if you've added a 10K boost.
Right.
You know, we don't know if it's over compressed snares or not. We just know if we like it or not. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where a well-produced song, a well-arranged song is always going to be much more important than the mixes at the end of the day.
Exactly. Because that's all people react to. And you're right. You know, like you heard the better quality. You're like, this is great. But, you know, maybe if you had lived with the really good quality one first and then went to the bad quality one, you'd be like, what happened to this? But you'd probably shrug and just still listen to the song because, like, at the end of the day, you just want to listen to the song.
Yeah. It was a great song. I still listen to it to this day.
It's almost embarrassing. Not embarrassing. I don't know if that's the right word. But I remember during that stage that everybody kind of goes through at the beginning of their audio engineering journey where they're overcritical of everything and hyper analyzing everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
For whatever reason, I remember being humbled because I listened to through Spotify, found all the songs I grew up listening to, and then being like, damn, half these songs are mixed not that great. And I'll be like, it's like, this is a Beyonce record. How is this? I'd be like, oh man, like I like hurt my pride.
But I think like later in life, that's kind of like grounding, if I can describe it that way. Like
that was an experience. Like, you know what? Experience. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, all of us have, or either do work with somebody that we want to build something great with, and we go that hard into the mix, and then we send it off to them, and then they're like, yeah, I think the vocals are a little quiet, can you like bring them up, and also can you take the snare down, can you do this, and you're like, I worked so hard on it. But at the end of the day, like you said, you know, listening back from when we were in a fan into like when we became overcritical, and I think it's because we wanted to learn more about compression, we wanted to listen for these things, we started becoming so analytical that we forgot about the record being the record more than the mix being the record. You know, and I don't know, I find it grounding nowadays to listen to a bad mix that did really well, just to always kind of reemphasize, hey man, like you want to do as best as you can. But if you start overthinking it and you forget that this isn't your record, but it's the artist's record at the end of the day, like we might be walking into a wall, not realizing the wall's right in front of us.
You know, sometimes you work with an artist and this isn't so much the way it is now, but when I was mixing, you know, in a studio attended, the artist or whoever, the producer maybe, would come in and they'd be like, they'd listen to the mix and, okay, now it's time for their notes. And like, all of a sudden you'd be getting this long dissertation on why the snare is too loud or whatever the change is, right? And it's just going on about the philosophy and then this and it's that. And I'd just be like, do you want it up or down, right? like, give me, you want it up or down, or do you want it up or down a lot, a little, tiny bit? Like, give me something. But like for them, it's like this thing that's about their creativity. And it's like, dude, it's not going to change the mix. It's not going to change how this mix hits. And if it does, we'll have a conversation about it. But like, I'm just going to do whatever you want right now within reason for these little like minute, what I would view as minute changes. I don't need to know why you think I placed this there. It could be because I'm tired. You know what I mean?
My ears are fatigued.
Because I'm mixing two songs a day. We're in day 10 here. I'm on my 10th mix, or on day five, I'm on my 10th mix, and I'm tired. So whatever. And so I even talk about that as mixer. Like, I'll say, just up instrument. They won't even tell you the instrument. They just start launching into this whole thing about why it's a problem and why, you know, how it could be better. And you're like, what instrument? Instrument, up or down, how much? That's all I want to know right now. And then we can talk about, like, because until I've heard it, like, everything you say, I don't know until I've heard it myself, you know? It could be genius. Actually,
That's the way I used to work, because I started off as a guitarist, just playing for the love of playing, and then fell in love with recording because we couldn't afford to record. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my bass player used to tell me all these ideas. He's like, hey, why don't you play that like an eighth note behind? It's like, what part? He's like, that one note. It's like, okay, cool. We are both musically illiterate. We just know everything by ear. So that doesn't tell me shit. How about you play it? And we would always have this relationship where he knew now, anytime he had an idea, listen, man, just play it for me.
Exactly.
Once you play it, I can understand. But like, until I hear it, like what you're telling me just doesn't make sense to me. Like, why would I play that note an eighth behind? Like, fine. But once we started recording together and everything, like, this really started to kind of like flourish in our relationship, where he'd be like, hey, I was thinking about changing up the bass line to it. Listen, don't tell me. I'm just going to playlist the take that we have now, record that new take, and we'll compare. And if we like it, cool.
Exactly.
You know, but some things are easier just like, hey, up, down, that's it. That's all I need to know. Outside of that, it's just a blur. Like, you're describing butterflies to a guy that eats crocodiles. Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
I have a funny anecdote as well. But before we do that, because we're coming to an hour here, I want to real briefly go over the rest of the sections, just so people know what's in the book. In a few sentences, Eric, the many roles of the producer for hire, section 4, what's that section about in just a few sentences?
That's, if you want to be a producer for hire and you're going to like, you're in charge of the whole project and you may have to rent studio time, you may have to rent side player or hire side players, rent instruments, whatever. You just got to get the record done. So you're a for hire producer. It goes through all of the things that you need to deal with as far as budget is concerned, and as far as, how to deal with the session, how to run the session, how to, deal with, personnel, so that you can understand the process and streamline it.
Great. Section 5 is the business.
That goes through the contracts, the basic producer's contracts, talks a little bit about a production company contract. I don't go into a ton of depth here. If you're really going to do a producer's contract, you should hire a lawyer. I say that right up front. Don't do this yourself. Hire a lawyer. You know, for me, for very simple contracts, like if it's just, you know, how many songs am I delivering by what date for how much money, I'll do that myself. But, you know, if it gets into anything else more like that has to deal with points or future monies or whatever, you really want to have someone who knows, A, the business standards, because if you make a contract that's not standard, it will be thrown out eventually. Like, people think, oh, I can put anything I want in a contract. No, if it does not follow usual best practices in the music business, which are already horrific enough, then, you know, it can be thrown out. So you definitely need a lawyer for whatever you do.
Mm-hmm. 6, studio projects.
Studio projects. I started this, came from Zen and the Art of Producing, and I kind of moved everything around. So now you got me like, shit.
Sorry, yeah, how did I? Choosing a winner, evaluating demos, the interview.
This is like how you deal with how you do all of that, deal with artists, figure out, you know, whether this is what we talked about earlier, you know, determining whether you're the right producer for the project and they're the right artist for you, so that you can save yourself some pain and pick projects that really make the most sense for you.
Cool. And it also seems like it's a lot about like how to make use of the time that you have allotted in the studio, which is really cool. And cueing the mix, singing to the mom. Okay. Number section, the one that, you know, we like, mixing and mastering.
Ooh, my fave.
Yeah. So, you know, like, you know, I wrote a whole book on mixing. So obviously I'm not putting all of that in this because it's for mixers anyway. People want to be mixers. But the way I laid out the entire book up to this point, you should be in good shape for mixing. So I really just address kind of the, you know, the basics and explain that, you know, how important the arrangement is. And then I talk about, you know, loudness and how you can effectively, how you get loudness and how you deal with gain, so basically taking this production that you've been working on for however long, and it's your production and you're intimately familiar with everything and really bringing it to completion.
There you go. Yeah, and you even have explaining what a TV mix is, instrumental acapella stems, like deliverables, loudness, oversampling, dithering.
And so I'll just say the whole book, you know, someone could say, well, that section's not for me. And maybe at this time it might not be for you, but it's still actually information that can help you in other areas. So I do recommend that people read the whole thing because it really gives you insight and overview of how everybody works. So, and if you know that, then it's a lot easier to figure out how you work. And then when you come along a project where you think, well, I'm not really qualified for that down the road, you have a reference to go back to where you could say, well, wait a second, maybe it's not as difficult as I think it is. And I have this roadmap to doing that.
Yeah, not only that, but I feel like the more you educate yourself on the roles of others, this is why, like, anytime I meet somebody new and I find out they do something, I like to ask, like, little questions about how they approach their work in certain scenarios, just because I think the more information you have on other people's roles, when it comes time to involve yourself with somebody of that type, it's easier for you to actually say, hey, something feels a little off, or no, this person knows what they're doing. Like, it's a good ability to. Somebody tried to call their way through, but it's a good resource to have the information when you're trying to understand, like, if the people you're dealing with feel like they understand what they're doing. Because let's say you are going to hire a producer at, let's say, $10,000 a song for the arrangements and everything. Like, $10,000 is a lot to a lot of people, you know. So having the information available to you, even if it's in a minuscule way, I feel like is nothing more than a resource at worst.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go get this book. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm a big fan of Mixer Man and the way that he explains things. Why am I talking to you in third person? The way that you explain things, Eric. I love the way that you explain things.
Appreciate
I've liked
that.
Your previous work. One of the only engineering specific books that I've actively recommended. And I say that, oh man, maybe it's a pride issue that I have. Maybe I should recommend more books, but I really vibe with the way that you explain things.
I appreciate
it's that. Available on Amazon, right? So mixerman.net is his website if you're looking interested in working with Eric in a bigger way, through his services. You've got also ebooks on Apple Books and Google Play. Other books include Zen and the Art of Mixing, Musician's Survival Guide to a Killer Record, and then your podcast, The Daily Adventures of Mixer Man. So you've got a lot of stuff out there. And obviously you're very knowledgeable and have worked on the most underrated skill that I think some humans are blessed with, some humans work really hard with, that you definitely have, is the ability to articulate, to organize thoughts and to articulate through writing, through speech. And that is definitely something that not very many people have. It's a killer weapon.
Yeah.
It's a killer weapon.
Industry.
Yeah, dude. I remember one of our mutual celebrity clients that will not be named that Lou and I have is
horrendous.
She writes incredible songs. People emotionally connect with these songs. She represents feelings and perspectives that people relate to. That's like, oh, like she understands me. In real life, cannot say a fucking relatable sentence. Like, she's speaking Chinese. I don't know. Like, yeah. I have no idea. Just incapable of communicating. Yeah. And I find that fascinating. You know, and maybe that's why they're into music, because they're aware of that they're struggling with communicating and they need to rely on music to communicate. Yeah. You know, maybe that's what it is. But whatever the reason. There'd be so much. Yeah, because you have to combine someone that knows what they're doing and then combine that with a killer instinct for articulation, which takes practice in its own right. All right. Yep. I think you're great. I think you should get the book. Even if you don't read it like a book front to back, keep it as a reference guide. I know that if I come into your studio and I see that you have this book, I'll be like, oh, like this guy actually cares about the craft. if I'm making a friend, if I'm making a judgment, it's like, oh, this guy cares. Right. And again, it's available online, ebook and audiobooks as well. So let's see. One last anecdote that you reminded me of. So I have to share this story because it's so fresh. It is so fresh. It happened this last week. You're going to laugh. I had an artist. They gave me a project that I mixed. And they're like, the drum sound isn't right. They hired a professional drummer, an acoustic drum set, mixed the drums, gave me a whole stack of tracks for the acoustic drums, and then the producer to digital drums, like some 808 type stuff to stack on top of it. It's supposed to be some hybrid thing. Every revision slowly over time was like less acoustic drums, more digital drums. Mm-hmm. And then the very last revision... The very last revision, I was like, I'm just going to mute the acoustic drums. And then they come back and say, that's the drum sound we're looking for. And I just do not have it. I just do not have the heart to tell them, like, they didn't have to hire the drummer.
Yeah.
I just shut up. I shut up. Didn't say anything. I hope to God they don't listen to this podcast.
If they're your friends, they listen.
I've never actually had an acoustic drum set work with an electric drum set. Like, it just makes the mix small. Like, it just never sounds right. Like, I always ended up muting them the same way. Like, it just doesn't work.
You know,
to me anyway.
It's kind of funny because this is exactly what I'm doing on tour. I'm touring right now with the rapper Exhibit. And so he has his DJ, and the DJ has like the TV mix version. So they have everything but the lead vocal, except for like some sparse parts. Yeah. And then we have a full band, like 44 inputs of band on stage. And we're talking like six toms, kick with double pedal and the whole dual hi-hat setup kind of thing. So I've kind of learned something about the difficulty about that with different people. Because normally I would just do front of house. And then usually I have like my mixes pretty dialed in for everybody's in-ears and things like that, because we're almost entirely on in-ears. But anytime I left monitor world to go do front of house, I would get notes back from the band. Like, I don't know who the monitor guy is, but the mix between like the drummer and like the tracks and everything was just way off. I've now kind of unintentionally became the monitor guy, because I found that too many people have that issue of like, I can't get the drums to cut through on top of a Dr. Dre record. And it's like, yeah, you have to mix it a very specific way for it to sound good. Outside of that, it just sounds like a bunch of kick drums going off, a bunch of snares going off, a bunch of toms on top of each other. Like, you gotta dial it in a very specific way for it to work. And if you don't, it's not going to work out. That is not a fun one to deal with. So DK, I apologize for all your revision stuff. I don't apologize. I didn't do that to you.
What a wild world that we live in.
It's a fun, creative one.
Anyway, that's the thing. We get to do music. What a silly thing we do. Like, really, like, what a silly, awesome thing that we get to do, just making music.
Yeah.
Anyway, before go on Amazon. Oh, go ahead. Yes.
Before you sign off. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. But I just wanted to ask, are you familiar with the Daily Adventures of Mixer Man at all?
I'm personally not.
The podcast.
No, well, it is a podcast, but it's actually, the podcast is actually an audiobook that came from a book. Are you familiar with that story at all?
No.
Please tell us about it.
Okay. So in 2002, when I was early days as Mixer Man and I was posting and I was running a forum, I started posting this diary, a blog about a recording session with an infamous producer in a bidding war band mm-hmm. for a major label. And so this thing, you know, it was a brand new forum. I was posting on it. There was maybe 200 people total on it. By the end of the week, I was getting, you know, I could see the view counts just going up. By the end of 4 weeks, I was having 25,000 people coming and reading this story, and the view counts were still going up. This is early, early days of the internet. Like, by the end, I had 150,000, which is like, in today's terms, that's just an astronomical number. Especially when you consider that it's for such a niche audience of basically anybody who's involved in making music. I was getting emails from people that were on tour with Bruce, with the Stones. Hey, you got to check out this diary, because nobody knew it was me because I was completely anonymous.
Yeah.
And, you know, the story just kept getting more and more ridiculous with this band who were kind of despicable, and the producer who was in way over his head because he wanted to use the old technology when they needed the new technology. And so I converted it to a book, How Leonard Signed It, as my first book in 2008, put it out there. In 2012, I made it an audiobook, a full production, which was like, you know, Firesign Theater style. Which is like the old radio, 40s radio style, where they're all performing it and they've got all their Foley stuff there and they make all the noises and stuff as it's going. So I produced it like that. Yeah, exactly. And then I converted it to a podcast because I didn't want to sell it as an audiobook anymore. I just wanted to make it available at this point since it's 20 years old. And you might think, oh, well, it's 20 years old. But I'm telling you, everything, all the themes in this book have much more to do with people and the creative process of making in a committee and for large corporations than the technology. And the technology has changed, but it hasn't, but it doesn't change the concepts in the book. So a lot of people have enjoyed this story, and a lot of younger people, which is your audience, I believe, are not familiar with it because it's, you know, it was so long ago. So if you want to like kind of get a glimpse into how major label records were made in the early aughts and some of the crazy shit that would go down in studios, you might want to check out that podcast and give it a listen. There's 52 episodes for the 52 chapters, and you know, it's like 11, 12 hours long. So take your time, but, and the first episode, and there's lots of music, tons of music. And in the first episode, I'm typing. Don't worry, I don't keep typing throughout the whole thing. That's just for the first chapter. But I just wanted to tell you guys about that because I know that a lot of younger people aren't really familiar with it and didn't live it and don't know about it.
You know, I'm actually going to download this because I, like I said, I fly out to Russia in a couple days, and I just found out yesterday it's an 18-hour flight, and I need to fill 18 hours before I drive myself insane on a plane.
This will do it.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually really curious about this.
Cool. Well, thanks for letting me tell you about that.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. Thank you, Eric. Again, it's as simple as going to Amazon and typing in single word Mixer Man. M-I-X-E-R-M-A-N. Single word. All of his books are on there. Print on demand, or like just get it in the mail. Get it. Keep it. Read it. Again, I endorse Eric. Man, I don't think I've ever said that about any other guest, really.
You don't endorse me, DK?
Yeah. Damn. Well, no, that's a given, dude.
You guys.
Yeah, dude, it's like we're married. Do I have to remind you we love each other? Yeah, like, I thought that was a given.
My wife is
like,
always arguing me about that. She's like, you know what? Tell DK you're sleeping with him.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much, Eric, for being a guest on the show, agreeing to come on. And we wish you the best of luck with this book. The rest of your career, like, until we hang out next time.
Dude, I forgot to tell you, I'm up for a tech award for this book, for the producing book.
That's cool.
So I'm one of five finalists for the tech award on it. And Tape Op is coming out with just an unbelievably great review in their next issue. They sent me an early release of that review. And the editor, Larry Crane, is raving about it. So I'm really happy about those two things. And I just wanted to tell you guys that.
That's cool.
That's awesome. Tape Op, Larry Crane says good things. It's not just me. I'm not, DK's not crazy, right? So like,
I'm not crazy.
Yeah, that's mostly the podcast is me convincing the audience I'm not crazy. Anyway, thank you so much for joining this podcast episode, for joining us on the Mixing Music Podcast. Thank you so much for listening to all the listeners. Again, we have exclusive episodes. One of the only ways we monetize the podcast is by joining our exclusive Patreon. That's mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive. There's more technical episodes. And on that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy. Hey, you. Yeah, you. Come join our Discord. The Mixing Music Discord server is filled with tons of awesome information and people. People that can help you out and information that can help you grow your business and to help you improve your mixes. So come join us and find the invitation link at mixingmusicpodcast.com.